gala festivities. Indeed, the biblical book, the Song of Songs, is a culled collection of the verse sung by such small groups at wedding feasts 3 millennia ago. Each one of the clans of Israel had its burl ives. A gentleman who was charged with the responsibility of memorizing the sing-song chanted history of the clan's past. To sing it, the great festivals and occasions of the clan, to transmit it to one in the next generation. It was in this means, through countless generations, that the great legendary prehistory of our people, the story of the patriarchs, the early stories of Genesis, were passed down to the 5th or 6th century before the Common Era, when some pious editor finally transcribed them and saved them for posterity. Indeed, in our Bible, we find the first recorded case of music used as an adjunct of psychiatric therapy. King Saul was subject to fits of deep depression and seizures of violent anger. His counselors advised him to hire one who was skilled on the lyre and who knew the ballads of Israel. They felt that music would soothe the savage beast within. So it was 3,000 years before Mr. Freud. Now, lest the young ones here feel that all of their ancestors were hollow-cheeked long hairs, let me insist, if the prophets can be believed, if Jerusalem had its full complement of cabarets with dance bands putting out disjointed syncopation, and indeed it was probably a king of Israel of all people who first danced the twist. You smile. But the Bible tells us that when King David had conquered Jerusalem and was bringing in the triumphal procession into the city, he was so caught up, gone, taken up by the sound of the horn, the Bible says, and by the beat of the percussion, that his limbs began to tremble. He tossed his torso hither and yon until he had to be reminded, as many a panting middle-aged husband of our own generation had to be reminded by his wife, Michael, "Well, after all, my dear, it's all right for the teenagers, but you know, really, you're king after all of Israel." There is still extant an 8th century B.C. inscription stone, Persian origin, in which one King Sennacherib recounts his conquests and the tribute which he levied upon all of his vassal states. From Moab, so many talents of silver and so many skins of wine. From Ammon, so many bars of gold and so many barrels of oil. From Israel, so many coin of the realm, of course. Of the second tribute is this: the best of the musician guild of the sanctuary. And on the picture side of this steel, one can see the silhouette of 3 of our broad-shouldered, bearded, strong ancestors marching to this command performance with a lyre in one hand and some wood instrument in the other. Then as now, the Metropolitan Opera of Baghdad ransacked the cantorial schools for their Tuckers and their Merrills and their Jan Pierces. The sweet singers of Zion were much in demand. Israel was noted for its music. And it is not, therefore, surprising to find that melody and liturgy were from the very first wedded in the worship of our people. Before the ark knew a final resting place, when it still traveled about between the centers of the amphictyonic union of the tribes of Israel, it was borne aloft and carried by a group of Levites. And these Levites sang as they marched from shrine to shrine, And out of these Levites and their descendants came the musicians group, which served for 1,000 years the musical needs of the sanctuary. The Bible has left us a description of the great dedication oratorio which was organized by King Solomon when he first brought into service the temple in Jerusalem. On one hand, a massed choir robed. On the other, another massed choir equally robed. They sang to each other. In the pit, a vast orchestra to accompany the music, divided by sections, percussion, wind, strings. Music of the temple was known. The Jews were proud of the music. Many of the Psalms recount to us the details of the processions and of the services held. One such observer sings out her glory or his glory. I have seen, she says, the procession. I have seen the procession unto my Lord, my King, my God. The singers went before. The stringed instruments followed after. And in the middle, the maidens danced with their tambourines. Imaginative interpretive dance, as well as imaginative chant and great instrumental music, was bound together in the ancient synagogue and the ancient temple to accompany, to embellish, to glorify Jewish worship. The Book of Psalms in our Bible is a collection of 150 of the best hymns sung in the temple. We have in the Book of Psalms the superscriptions directed to the conductor, which tell him the tempo and the key in which he is to conduct. Unfortunately, to our loss, we can no longer understand, translate most of these directions. But the Talmud is certainly correct when it sums up the whole first 1,000 years of Jewish musical development when it says that song was obligatory in the worship of the sanctuary. And indeed, it was obligatory in the worship of the synagogue, which succeeded the sanctuary when Rome finally razed the temple in 70 of the Common Era. Indeed, for 2,000 years until our very day, the traditional synagogue has been a synagogue of the chant, of song, where the spoken word was almost never heard. Music is part of the wharf and the roof of Jewish worship, intimate, essential, and elemental. But like every love match which eventuates in marriage, there were problems, spats, tensions now and again. The first problem which faced this marriage of melody and liturgy was the problem of selection, the quality of music to be presented. Ancient worship was quite different than our own. It was either a vast, magnificent priestly pageant performed on a raised altar far from the congregation, to which they thronged and viewed, by which they were entertained, but in which they did not at all participate. Or it was an ecstatic, fervent performance, one in which men sought to be possessed of the gods, to commune with the gods, to speak with tongues. Prayer was not of the essence in the ancient worship of the pagan cults. We call their worship Dionysia. The band would begin to play, the tambourines to beat out a rhythm. The people would dance jerkily here and there, very much like the dervishes of the Indian world today. They would seek to become caught up by their gods, possessed, and they would fall down when possessed, foaming at the mouth on the ground, speaking with tongues, uttering supposedly the word which God had implanted in them. They were acting as his spokesman. In the Bible, occasionally, we can still glimpse dim visions of this very ancient past. Of the semi-legendary figure of Elisha, it is said that when the cymbals began to beat and the tambourine to play, he became possessed of God. But by and large, Jewish worship from the very beginning was quite otherly directed. Jewish worship represents as radical a departure in the way of faith as does our faith itself, the belief in the one God. The Jews sought to worship in quietness. The Hebrew word tefillah means not ecstasy, not ritual, but introspection, meditation, reflection. And so the problem which faced the Jew from the very beginning was to create, to discipline, to control a body of music which would express his transcendently new view of faith as the communion within by the inner man with God. To us moderns, it seems self-evident. We know that these ecstatic self-induced states are nothing more than a means of lowering the barriers between our conscious and our unconscious, and the mouthings which come forward are not God sent, but simply the spewings out of the unconscious thoughts which are roiling about in the darkness within. To us it seems self-evident that prayer is of the heart of worship. But this was not always so. And 3,000 years before our psychologists refined this discipline of the mind, Jews were convinced that the worship of the one God, the God whose service was in morality, this worship could be effective only if it were disciplined, only if it were brought inside, only if the congregation were controlled, only if it was formal, tied to words. Take with thee words, a prayer book. Take with thee words, the Bible says, and come unto the Lord thy God. And it is for that reason that Jewish music from the very beginning, as it was tied up to worship, became formal and was circumscribed. The prayers could be sung only to certain modes. And many of these cantillations and chants have come down to us over the long years. We have, in another form, this problem of selection still with us today. Occasionally, we will read in our press of some congregation, Jewish or non-Jewish, which attempts to present its sacred music in some modern, say, a jazz mode. And inevitably, quite a furor is raised within the congregational ranks itself. This problem of the suitability of music comes to us because we are wrong if we believe that music is a universal language. Music is a conventional language. I had this driven home to me when I was stationed for 2 years in the Far East. I could understand the drift, the larger purpose of Japanese music, but never its subtleties, never the fullness of its meaning. This escaped me, for I did not know the conventions of the Japanese music. I did not know its traditions, nor was I familiar with the larger, almost instinctive thought patterns by which every culture expresses itself. And so it is with us. So it is with any who live in an age of change, of rapid societal change. Our music must speak to us. If any of us were to hear the music sung 3,000 years ago in the temple, we would find it discordant, disturbing, not at all ennobling. And yet, 3,000 years ago, the congregation of equally wise and understanding and pious men and women would have found that music to their taste suitable, quite seemly. We must find in this day and age music which not only gives us the pious sonorities of the King James Version of the Bible, but of the bland staccato of our own tongue, of the revised versions. Translated into Jewish terms, we must find music which not only reflects the pious intimacy, the simplicity of faith, the grayness of life, the unadorned quality of existence which was the lot of our ancestors in the ghetto. We must find a music of faith but which speaks of us, complicated, somewhat rootless individuals, free in a prosperous age, in a troubled age, anxious in prosperity, whose faith cannot be as simple, as unadorned, as was the faith of our ancestors. And so when we hear the medieval music of the synagogue, we thrill to its simplicity. We quaver with its tears. But we find that as the music of the synagogue, unembellished by music which spoke more direct, which speaks more directly to us, we would find it to be unsatisfying. It would not lift up our hearts and place our thoughts, our innermost feelings, before our God. And that is why this music in which we are all rejoicing this morning is so important. Ernst Bloch's Avodat HaKodesh stands on its own musical integrity. It needs no defense or explanation. But historically, within Jewish liturgy, it played and plays a distinct role. This music was written in the year 1931. It was written while Ernst Bloch was on a sabbatical leave in Italy, financed in his creativity by some fine foundation. It was the first attempt by a man of qualified, whose control of music was beyond question. A man who was master of all forms of theory and of direction. A man who had composed much, was yet to compose brilliant things. It was the first attempt by a Jewish composer to take our liturgy and to tie it to musical notes, modes, conventions, which bespoke our modern life. In many ways, it is the pioneering work which signals the renaissance of Jewish liturgical music, which we are all rejoicing in to this day. Ernst Bloch set out to speak what was in his heart, to speak of a man raised and trained at a great university, aware of the political and of the social and of the scientific problems and opportunities of his day. He drew from the past, but he wrote with his heart and with his mind as a man of today. He speaks to us, as do all of the composers and writers who have taken our liturgy since his day and transcribed for us melodies and themes which touch and ennoble and give us new confidence. There's a second problem raised by the wedding of melody and of liturgy. I call it the problem of balance. We are surprised to find in the Bible, having said all that I have said about the intimacy of music to worship, an outraged Amos thundering against music in the sanctuary. I will not listen, he says. I will not listen to the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the noise of your harps. Take these away from my presence. I will have none of them. And what was he outraged? What was the cause of his concern? I believe it to have been this. That is so often in priest-ridden societies. Each great festival was accompanied by a magnificent oratorio or a pageant. Musicians were brought in from all corners of the earth. Music aesthetically superb was presented. The ritual was adorned gloriously. But somehow, the essence of ritual was forgotten. Prayer had no place. Music shouldered its way to the forefront of the hour of worship and pushed out from the hour in the temple all thought of prayer, all concern with that which is essential with worship. Our worship begins with a prayer book. It begins by looking within. The thoughts of the prayer book are to act as springboards to force each of us to consider our own lives, to ask the basic questions. Who am I? What is my purpose in life? How am I using my talents? Wisely, or am I dissipating them? What do I really believe? Not what do I say to my friends, but what is really in my heart? Do I make to myself promises of self-discipline which I have no intention of fulfilling? Am I truly and honestly out to serve God, to help my fellow man, or is this all some hollow pretension? Worship is designed to force us to confront the reality of our life situation. We read these prayers written by great spirits because they suggest to us themes worthy of our consideration. And the music of our worship is intended to allow us a few moments after each prayer for introspection, to go beyond the words into the heart. Music must capture the flavor of the prayer. And if it captures it, it will somehow subtly carry us along, force us to take the plural, the we of the prayer, and translate it into the singular, the I of meditation. And when this happens, then God truly graces our worship and kisses it with its presence, for then truly our worship has significance. But worship and melody must be kept in balance. For symphony has a full-blown, has a virtuoso tone, but it belongs in Severance Hall, not in the sanctuary. For music unadorned allows us to escape from reality. It does not force us to do that which we least like to do, to look in at the mirror of the life and to say, not mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of them all? Mirror of my soul, of what art thou made? Who am I? Am I a hollow man? Am I a whole man? If I am hollow, how can I become whole? If I am less than whole, how can I complete my being? There's a lovely Greek myth which runs to the effect that a certain young prince, Amphion, was filled with eagerness to drink deeply of life's adventure. In his late teens, he left his ancestral home. He wandered the length and breadth of Greece, performing many a heroic act. But he soon tired of the homeless life, and he returned to his city, only to find when he came over the brow of the hill that the city, his house, the courtyard of his play, all these had been ruined and laid waste by some invading army. Almost without thinking, the weight of his heart forced him down upon a gray stone. He began to sing some wordless tune of lament. His hand picked up his lyre and he began to strum. And according to this ancient legend, so heartfelt, so beautiful was this music that the stones picked themselves up one by one, rebuilt of their own strength the city. Music is magical powers. Magical in the sense that we do not fully understand how it operates within. Our lives are fragmented. Many of our hopes have been shattered. We live in tension. Our age is one of anxiety. Yet if we can sing the melody of the heart, if we can express the tune that lies lodged within, somehow the pieces of life of themselves build themselves up. They come together. We become whole. And when great music is wedded to a great liturgy, as it is in our own, as it has been this morning, we find echo in that music of that which cries out for expression in our hearts. Somehow the music gives wings to the words, and the words give wing to our resolutions, and our resolutions go on their winged course in our daily life outside these doors. And then we have the greatness of worship, its ultimate vindication, for it is not an hour of leisure. It is not an hour of learning. It is an hour of love of God, for the love of God which expresses itself in the love of the life he has given us. Not simply to clutch this life to us, but to take this life and with its vigor, with its energy, return to God by our actions a doubled and redoubled portion of blessed service to our fellow men. For that is the purpose of his creation, and that is the vindication of our being created. Amen.